Well, good morning. How's everybody doing? Happy Friday. Delighted to be here. And thanks to the Grant Taggart Symposium for the opportunity to speak with you today, although I really would like to talk to the person who thought it was a great idea that I follow Van Muller on stage. You know, I listened to Van, and a lot of his message, I will say, yeah, whatever he said is, you're actually going to see how relevant what he said, hopefully, in the words that I have. One of the things that he was doing was he was making me feel like I had to confess to him. You know, when he was saying, answer me! So, Van, I'm going to confess to you. I'm an analytic. I'm an actuary. And in fact, I spent most of my career as a healthcare actuary. And I'm a grandpa. So thank you for the messages, Ben. They were terrific. My first visit to Utah, everybody I talked to when I told them I was coming here said, oh, what a beautiful place. And they were so right. What a beautiful place. I've had the opportunity to spend a couple of days here with Brady and his team. And for those of you that live here, you know how lucky you are. So it's a great place to be. It's also a great time to be here. You may or may not know, we are now smack dab in the middle of Life Insurance Awareness Month. A little tidbit that you can take back with you. So I couldn't imagine a better time or a better place to talk with you about whole life insurance, and that's what we're going to do. Hopefully I can maneuver myself here. A little constrained here on the keyboard. Okay, so let's get started, and I would say throughout the presentation, anybody has any questions or comments, we can make this as conversational as you would like. Here's an agenda. What I'd like to do is just start with kind of a baseline of the major types of life insurance that are offered in the market today and their features. We'd like to talk about some industry trends that are going on in the market today, rating agencies, how they, what they think about in terms of whole life. I'm going to be focusing on participating whole life today. Building a holistic financial plan, we're going to talk briefly about that, things that you do every day, and then a planning concept that we like to use when we're talking to our producers. Okay, so we're featuring whole life this morning, but what I thought I'd do is just start by depicting the major forms of life insurance in the marketplace today. A lot of this is going to be review for a lot of you. Hopefully, we will have something for everyone during the next few minutes. Anyway, the slide here depicts the major forms of life insurance that are offered: term, no lapse guarantee UL, indexed universal life, variable universal life, and participating whole life. On the right-hand side, you'll see the major attributes that define each of these product forms. Each product form actually has a variation. There are variations of each. For example, term can be an annual renewable term. It can be a 20-year term, as an example. But those key attributes on the right-hand side define each of these groups of types of products. A couple of the products really are primarily focused or almost totally focused on the death benefit. Term life insurance, of course, is death benefit coverage. No lapse guarantee, universal life, really was built to focus on the death benefit, even though potentially there's a cash value component. And then the other forms have cash accumulation possibilities as part of the attributes of the product. So in addition to death benefits, there's a focus on accumulation of cash within the product form. And that accumulation depends on the combination of guarantees and the opportunity to take on more investment risk via investing in the equity markets. So variable universal life and index universal life have that opportunity via either via direct investment in the equity markets or via indices. We're going to get into a little more detail on participating whole life, specifically the dividend scale. That really is the differentiator for PAR whole life. And I would argue that at least a part of the definition of dividends and the determination of dividends is akin to investing in the equity markets. And we'll talk about that when we get there. So again, focus on participating whole life. Want to make it clear that I think and we think at our company, MassMutual, that participating whole life is a very, very good product. But I also want to make it clear that we understand that it's not the only product out there. That's why I wanted to start here, just to acknowledge that there is a spectrum of products out there, each of which can fit into a financial plan depending on customers' needs and interests. So let's get into a little more detail on whole life. Before I go any further, can I just ask who regularly, and you can define regularly however you like, sells whole life? Okay, that's about what I expected. How about participating whole life? Pretty much the same group. Okay. No, pardon me? No lapse guarantee, UL. Index UL, same group. And variable UL, less. Okay, so very much in line with trends in the market that we'll go over. Okay, quickly, and this is where I would say a lot of Van's comments, I would just say, yeah, what he said. There are, you can read on this page the word guaranteed a lot. Okay, the basic idea of whole life is guaranteed premium for the lifetime of the policy, guaranteed death benefit, and guaranteed accumulation of cash values. Pretty simple. When I say guaranteed, what I mean is at least as good as defined at issue. So premiums that are defined at issue for the lifetime of the policy will never be greater than that definition at issue. Death benefit defined at issue will never be less than that definition, and cash values will accumulate at the minimum rate that's defined at issue, but they could accumulate at a greater rate. And all of those ifs are dependent on the dividend scale. Dividends are, in fact, the differentiator for a participating whole life policy. Dividends make the difference between a PAR whole life policy and any other type of product out there in the market. And what I wanted to do is just talk with you a little bit about how they're determined. There are two aspects to the definition of dividends, determination of dividends. The first is based on the experience within the product. So you have to understand when premiums are first determined for a particular death benefit, for a particular age cohort, et cetera, the assumptions that go into that determination of premium are conservative. On purpose. Think about a whole life policy where someone can own that policy for 30, 40, 50, 80, longer number of years. We actually just paid a death claim on someone who owned their policy for 97 years. At our company, as an example, we have over 100,000 customers that have been with us 50 years or longer. So when we're setting assumptions for a policy like this, there's literally no way that we're going to be able to understand everything that's going to happen between now and, say, the year 2100. But there are people who are buying whole life policies now who will still have that policy in the year 2100. So we set these, and for participating whole life policies, premiums are set on a conservative basis. The assumptions include mortality, interest, and expenses, with the idea that over time we will look deeply, we will analyze the experience, and we will make the determination how that experience is coming out relative to the initial assumptions. And I would tell you, way more often than not, the actual experience comes in better than the combination of assumptions that are used to set the premium. So what do we do with that excess? That is the first part of the dividend scale. We take, through a relatively complex set of calculations, we take the excess of what has actually been received via premium and what's needed to cover the experience and put that into the dividend scale. And that determination is made every year. Part one. There's a part two that I think is in many ways more interesting than that. And it has to do with a concept called other business earnings, or OBE. Other business earnings are very simply exactly what they sound like. They are earnings of businesses that are non-participating businesses in the company. Now, you have to remember when you're thinking about OBEs that participating policyholders are the owners of the company. Mutual companies do not issue stock to the general public. Their owners are the owners of participating policies. So when you think about an owner, you think about, well, you know, like any company, the earnings that are generated in that company are available to the owners to take out, frankly, at any time. So that's the concept here with other business earnings. The other earnings of the company, and in the case of our company, we own asset managers, we own Oppenheimer Funds and Barings, we own an international company, we own a retirement services company. All of those businesses are non-participating. The results of those businesses are then put in a pile, and the board of directors takes a look at them every year and says, okay, how much do we need to keep to make sure that we have support for our current book of business? How much do we need to keep for investments that we know we're going to have to make in the businesses to keep them competitive? How much do we need to keep to ensure that the rating agencies are comfortable with the surplus that we have in the company? Okay, we have some left over. Let's put that back into the dividend. Those are the two pieces of the dividend. As I said a few minutes ago, this piece of the dividend, the OBE piece, is very much akin to someone investing in the equity market. You are an owner. You are participating in the performance of these other businesses. There is quite a big difference in that investing in the stock market, in the open stock market, there is open market bidding on those shares. And that will tend to add some volatility to the price of those shares. That's not the case here. You're investing in the company. You're enjoying the benefit of the earnings that are produced by those other businesses, but there's still no open market bidding. So in a way, it's like investing in the equity markets. In a way, there's actually an argument to be made for less volatility. And then finally, what can be done with these dividends that are given back to the policyholder? They can take them in cash. They can use them to reduce premium, which is why I said premium will never go up, but it might come down. They can use them to buy more death benefit through what are referred to as paid-up additions, which would also increase cash values. 90% of the dividends that we pay back to our customers go toward paid-up additions. So that's the most popular version of the use of dividends. So that is, in effect, the big differentiator for a participating whole life policy. What do the rating agencies think of this product? And in a nutshell, they like it a lot. And the reason they like it a lot is because of the buffer that is embedded in the product from the beginning with those conservative assumptions. Now, understanding that we will eventually, or the company will eventually give back the excesses that are generated from that buffer. So it's not as though it's kept in the company, but having that buffer, understanding that we have a product that can last 60, 70, 80 years is something that is viewed by the rating agencies as very positive. You guys are in this business. You understand how important financial strength ratings are. Financial strength ratings depict how well a company can manage its risks. And there really are risks at two ends of the spectrum. One is the long-term risk that I've been talking about, life or disability risks. The other is liquidity risk, to the extent that our policyholders are asking for their assets because they want to take them elsewhere through an annuity contract, say. We have to have enough cash on hand to make sure, we meaning the company, has to have enough cash on hand to make sure that we can pay those amounts out. So there's really kind of a barbell of risks here that need to be managed in an insurance company, and the rating agencies view whole life, participating whole life insurance as a way for a company to contribute to its management of those risks through the generation of surplus and through those buffers that are embedded in the product. Let's take a look at a couple of trends in the life insurance market. You can see here that overall, since between 2012 and 2016, the market grew in premium from $9.9 billion to $11 billion. I would also point out that if you look at the dark blue box at the bottom of the $1.1 billion of growth that for this period, $900 million of that growth was garnered in the whole life, in whole life products. So very, very popular over the last 5 years in terms of sales growth. It's kind of interesting to look at the history of these various products. If you go back to mid-90s, you would see variable universal life as actually the top universal life product that was sold at that time. It was very hot. The stock market was hot. Everyone wanted in. Then we got to the early 2000s. Stock market took a hit, and variable universal life became a victim of that. That's when no-lapse guarantee universal life was created. And the sales of that product have gone great guns until a couple of years ago, when the low interest rate environment has kind of caught up with the pricing of that product. No new news to folks who are in that market. And index universal life is now the number one growth product in the universal life market. It's estimated that about half of the sales of universal life sales today are index UL sales. During this time, whole life sales have grown about 30%. Our estimate is about 70% of whole life sales are participating whole life. Why whole life? I think it comes down to the guarantees that are embedded in the product that Van was talking about earlier. That is a big concept, a big word. People are looking for guarantees today, and the level of guarantees that are required as per the definition of life insurance are actually quite attractive today. And the performance with dividends. So guarantees and performance, I think, have driven the about 30% growth in whole life sales over this period. This, I think, is kind of an interesting slide as well. This talks about whole life sales and where they're coming from a channel perspective. No surprise, over half the sales of whole life are done by career agents. By the way, how many career agents do we have in the audience today? Oh, okay. And the rest are taken up by several other channels here that I'd like to talk about as defined by LIMRA. You'll see the broker channel. And actually, if you look at the combination of insurance brokers and independent agents, you'll see that in combination, they've actually grown about 50% over this period of time, from $600 million to $900 million. So that's not nothing. That's significant. We have seen, with the brokers that we have worked with, a shift during this time frame away from universal life, away from no lapse guarantee universal life, toward whole life. Not wholly, but it is discernible, and I think this speaks to it. You'll also notice that above those lines is a line for direct, and selling direct is really an up-and-coming type of channel. At first, selling direct was geared toward millennials. I mean, the whole idea here is getting access to folks that you otherwise would not have access to, or frankly, can't afford to have access to because of where they are in their life and what their needs are. What we have found at MassMutual is, even though we started out shooting for millennials going direct, we've also seen non-millennials, or older folks like me, also finding that they want to go direct. And the reason for that, we think, is because they want quicker turnaround. Quicker turnaround is one of the forms of easier to do business with that I think everybody is looking for today. Going direct is the first part of that. I think part of the underwriting process is another part of that. You're all familiar with algorithmic underwriting? Anybody? No. Okay, so less folks familiar with it than I thought. So let me stop and talk about that a little bit. Algorithmic underwriting, excuse me, is a version of the robotics craze that is taking over virtually every industry. The whole idea here is the ability to automate decision making that is done manually, or automate work that is done manually, will enable quicker turnaround. It will also enable more consistent decision making. We have, and quite a few companies have implemented a version of algorithmic underwriting. Idea here is make it easier for me, make it quicker for me, reduce the amount of time and the amount of effort I have to spend to buy an insurance policy. You all know the statistics. Half of the households in the United States are either uninsured or underinsured. So, you know, Van's pleading about, you know, all of the opportunity that there is out there. It's enormous. It's absolutely enormous. And going direct is a way to reduce the hassle factor for writing an insurance policy that we think is a factor in households being underinsured and uninsured. So algorithmic underwriting is simply going to automate decision making and standardize it so that it's going to make a quicker turnaround. The next leap in algorithmic underwriting, which is in place today for some companies, for some sections of the market, is fluidless underwriting. Idea being, instead of having to obtain a blood sample or a urine sample, using other ways to determine especially whether or not someone is a smoker is a trend that is happening. And there's no question that in some near-term time frame, I'll call that 3 to 5 years, companies are going to crack this code, and they're going to get to the point where fluidless is more prevalent than non-fluidless. Again, because individuals are looking for ways to do business easier and quicker. So that's a trend that I think if we look at this graph 5 years from now, I think you're going to see direct be a bigger portion of the total. And hopefully the overall growth is going to be even faster because of things like algorithmic underwriting and within that going fluidless. One other band that I'd like to just refer to, it's a small band today. It's worksite. It's near the top in gray. Sales at worksite are still around 100 million. They're not very big portion of the total. We think it's going to be a bigger portion of the total. And the reason we think that is because we look at worksite benefits and voluntary benefits and how they have grown over the last 10 to 12 years at a rate that is close to double digits, not quite, 8 or 9% a year, every single year for that time frame. That is a huge number for growth. We think that's only going to continue or actually grow. And the reason for that is employers are finding that they can't afford a full benefits package like they used to, and but they still want to provide a valuable service, a valuable set of benefits to their employees. How do they do that? One way they do that is through voluntary benefits. That is, they actually do the review of the product that would be offered to their employees, but they're not paying for it. They're asking their employees to pay for it. The portability of a product, the affordability of a product, and the fact that employees, when asked, would you prefer to buy insurance on your own or through your employer, over half of them would say, through my employer. So we think that that line is also going to get bigger in this chart. Okay, I'm going to keep going. Again, any questions, please raise your hand. I thought we'd just touch a bit on building a holistic financial plan. Yes, sir. Question is, have we done any experimentation with facial underwriting? The answer is no, not yet, but that's not to say we haven't talked about it. So that is an example of how companies are going to crack the code of fluidless. Finding ways either through facial recognition or lifestyle questions, those types of things. But there are a lot of questions, regulatory questions that we're going to have to answer there. So good question, and I think that is indicative of the types of things that we're going to be talking about. Yes, sir.
Do you see, as an actuary, do you see companies moving towards on top of blood work or invasive blood work, putting like Fitbits and stuff on people's arms for a couple weeks and analyzing all that data as part of underwriting?
Yeah, the question is, does the healthy lifestyle trend of Fitbits, does that fit into the underwriting process at all? And I think the answer is sort of, yeah. Not entirely as a replacement. You know, there are the trend in the marketplace over the last few years has been actually from a honestly from a sales point of view to attract certain types of folks that have a certain healthy lifestyle, which, by the way, parenthetically, being a person who was in the HMO business 25 years ago, that's what HMOs were doing. So, you know, no idea is a new one. But, yes, I think, you know, it might become the same. It might be akin to the same thing that car insurance companies are doing now, which is, you know, we put a little monitor in your car to monitor how you're driving, and if you agree to that, we'll give you a discount. There's nothing to say that insurers, life insurers, aren't going to be doing the same type of thing. Is there another question? Question is, will direct to consumer affect the agent? Funny enough, I was at our agency earlier this week and the same question came up. Well, my answer, and it's not the only answer, but my answer is I believe that this is not an on-off switch. I do not believe that one is going to replace the other. I think eventually the market is going to settle in to just as we are doing with algorithmic underwriting. We can make decisions, we can program decisions in underwriting. You know, we know that if A, B, C, and D, every single time an underwriter is going to add up those facts and make the same determination, why can't we program it? Same type of kind of analogy with direct to consumer, where if it's a relatively straightforward sale, there is room for even agents to encourage someone to go direct because that's not where they're adding the most value. Where they're adding the most value is where I believe it will stay on a face-to-face relationship. And we're going to have to determine together where that value lies. So the point is this would open up more opportunities for direct selling. I believe that's an example of the market dictating where we need to go. This isn't a matter of us making up, you know, something and then, you know, kind of feeding it to the market. It's the market telling us that we have to be easier to do business with. You know, if not, we're not going to close that gap of the uninsured and the underinsured. Yes, sir. What are some chances? I'm sorry?
Sorry, so you talked about food. This yes. Underwriting.
Yes.
What are some channels through which companies are going to start getting that type of information?
Some channels of.
And then you talked about, you know, there's other ways to verify if someone is a smoker and their smoking habits.
Oh, I think we're still talking about how we're going to get the information. I don't think we have that yet. Some of this is, you know, like the question here on facial recognition and. You know, there might be some, you know, lifestyle type things. There are some regulators who are already voicing their opinion, I think rightfully, that we need to be very careful in terms of where we're actually going to go get that information. So if you're thinking like social media, it's like that's not, you know, right now that's not in the ballgame. We're not kind of thinking that. But we do have to. We do have to think through if we're going to make this an easier process. Where can we legitimately get information that, you know, will help us to, you know, verify what's going on? There's a question up here. Excuse me.
What impact will genetic testing? You know, you can
Right. Right now, the answer is none. We actually have discussed this with a company that does that, and we have made it clear that that is not something that, you know, we're going to take into account. That's just right now the the market and the regulatory environment, and you know, it's not ready to be used. I can't tell you whether or not it ever will be used. I mean, this is all kind of like speculation. We were talking about this the other day. I'll give you an example. When I back in the early 2000s, I went to a store and bought a golf driver for my bag, and then 2 days later, I got an advertisement for golf equipment, and I wasn't happy. I was ripped because I felt like, you know, the creepy factor had, they had gone over the line. Well, now it's like, yeah, sure, you know, I'm going to get an ad, you know, just about every time I make a purchase, and that's okay. So, you know, things change, that line changes, and we're just going to have to make sure that we're all in sync here so that, you know, we're not getting ahead of ourselves and everyone understands what's going on. Oh, yes. Just to be clear, there still will be an underwriting process. We're not throwing out, you know, the baby with the bathwater. There's other things that are going to be considered. It's just that I'm just trying to give an indication of where things are going. Yes, sir. That's a difficult question. The question is, how do we reconcile the additional regulatory items that are imposed on the industry with the market's need, with customer's need, a consumer's need, and interest in ease of doing business and turning things around more quickly? I don't really have a group. I think everything you're saying is valid. You know, I'm just going to go back to Van, and you know, what he was talking about in terms of the value that you folks can bring to the sales process. I think that's real. There's no question that that's real. It's a question of how do we get that out there. All of these trends are real as well, and my only point is, our job. Our collective job is going to be to reconcile them so the market is satisfied, as well as we are feeling as though we are able to bring the full capabilities to the marketplace. You know, that's kind of motherhood and apple pie, but that's kind of where we are right now. We're in the early stages of it. Yes, sir.
Some companies at 4.5.
Okay, I'm not going to give you any predictions on dividends. That's not something that I either want to do or I would be allowed to do. So answer to that one is you can kind of...
Just some thoughts or feelings that you might have.
Low interest rate environments have recently brought dividend scales down.
Sure.
Okay, draw your own conclusion in terms of where it's going from that. Why are dividend scales so different by company? I think it goes back to how they are put together. Number one, how much buffer is initially put in the rates. Number two, how does the underwriting process play out? Number three, what kinds of other investments has that company made, and what kind of returns in those OBEs are coming through? I can invest in a, if I'm an insurance company, I can invest in a 50-year bond, if that's what I want to do, or I can invest in a business. What do I want to do? What do I think makes the most sense? And, you know, that opens up, you know, a huge potential difference between, you know, one company versus the next. Okay, thanks for the questions. That's great. Let's move on quickly. The whole idea here with a holistic financial plan is to once again emphasize that each of these forms of life insurance has its advantages, depending on whether the focus is on protection only or, you know, all the way over to maximizing my upside and willingness to take on additional interest rate risk, market risk. And we position participating whole life right in the middle in that there are guarantees, but there are also, with that dividend, the potential for some upside. So when we're thinking about a holistic financial plan, of course, you know, these various forms of life insurance come into play. But when we're thinking about a holistic financial plan, of course, it's not limited to life insurance. Here you see a depiction of a tool that we have built that is actually made available to individuals at the work site. The whole idea here is, when I am thinking about my own benefits package at my company, that my company's offering, how should I be allocating my money between the major risks that I have? Healthcare, life or death, disability, and retirement or longevity. Most people really don't have a clue and frankly admit that they don't have a clue. So what we did was we developed this tool that uses data from a very, very short list of questions that we ask folks, like, are you married? Do you own or rent? How many kids do you have? And there's one or two others. And what this village depiction is an actual route through the various risks that an individual has. The hospital on the left-hand side, for example, is depicting healthcare as the risk. What this tool does is it takes that information and, based on the persona that is developed from the information, there are about 300 different personas, comes back with a recommended allocation of dollars across these four major risk categories. In virtually every case, healthcare is number one. You have to have health care. In most cases, retirement is last. It's the lowest priority. As one of the folks that I've worked with in the retirement business says all the time, retirement is an optimistic point of view. There's an awful lot of things you have to take care of before you can actually get comfortable allocating money to retirement. And so we then end up with the two in the middle, life and disability. And what we found is disability is probably the most understood and underestimated of all the risks. So what I thought I'd do is just take a quick diversion. I know I've only got 3 minutes left here, but wanted to just mention that when an individual enters the workforce, 25% of them will be somehow disabled before they retire. That's probably higher than a lot of people think. So, you know, to get people thinking about this disability risk, a good question to ask might be, what do you think is your most valuable asset? Some might say their home, some might say their car. Their most valuable asset in a large majority of cases is their earnings potential. So, again, I'm gonna quickly go through this. The idea here is there may very well be a gap between what they would need if they were disabled and what they actually would get. Some may have no disability coverage. Some may have disability coverage through the workplace. There are options to talk to someone about a portable, non-cancelable type of disability product that pays tax-free benefits and can cover things like bonuses and, you know, higher paid individuals. And this might be a way for you to start a conversation with somebody or extend a conversation with somebody that you have as a current customer. Okay, I'm going to rifle through this last section. This is the planning concept that we that I referred to earlier. I'm going to go through these slides quickly and just give you the example. And here's Ben, 65, retired. He's got $1 million. He needs $75,000 in pre-tax income a year to live. That's pretty tight, by the way. 7.5% of your retirement savings is pretty high. We're usually looking at more like 4 or 5. Average annual return for Ben's IRA, this was 73 to 93. And you're saying, okay, I'm cherry picking the time frame. I could have picked a worse time frame. I could have picked 2000 to 2017. And it would have been worse. I just want to show you an example of how having whole life as thinking about it as a retirement asset is something that might be of interest to you and might be a conversation that you can have with someone. So the idea here is if I take out $75,000 a year and I'm Ben and I started with $1 million, where do I end up with in this scenario after 20 years? And good. He was right. You know, he had $430,000 left after 20 years. But was that the smartest thing he could have done? And here's where the concept of whole life as a retirement asset and an asset that is not connected or tied to the equity markets makes a lot of sense. How about if Ben said, in any of those years where there were negative returns, I'm not going to take out money from my IRA, I'm going to take money out as a disbursement from my whole life policy. By the way, that would be an after-tax disbursement. So I only need to take out $54,000 rather than $75,000, assuming a 28% tax. What happens is if I take that strategy, anytime there was a negative return, I go to my life insurance policy. I don't take out from my IRA. Taking out from my IRA after a negative return is like buying low and selling high. You don't want to do that. Leave it in there. If I did that, if he did that, he would end up with a balance not of $430,000, but a balance of $2.6 million in this case. Now, it is intended to be instructive here in terms of an example, but this is the type of concept that the application of whole life as a retirement asset can be. And what ends up happening, because there was a minimum distribution in there, he actually took out a little bit more than he originally intended, but he also ended up with $2.2 million more. Sorry I had to rifle through that, but those questions were terrific. I thank you very, very much for your attention and appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Bart.
And now we're going to take about a 15-minute break. Please go visit the exhibitors, and we'll see you back here in 15 minutes or so.